I want to begin today by telling a couple of stories which are inspired by and connected with stories that Ingrid told last night about when the Master wants to give us something, we better take it. And the first one is with Master Kripal and goes back to the 1963 tour when Judith and I managed to follow, and actually Miriam and Eric also managed to follow the Master on much of that tour, but financially speaking, it was a very tight squeeze. You know, I had lost my job a couple of months before Master came, which was a very good thing because it enabled me to work full-time getting what became Sant Bani Ashram ready for him. And on the other hand, getting it ready for him also involved quite a lot of expense. And of course, we didn't have any income coming in, so we actually went into debt getting the place ready. For us, October 11th, which was the day that he was coming, was the end of the world. We didn't go beyond that. Everything was set up for, in our minds for his coming, and that was it. Anyway, October 11th came and went, and the Master came and went, and it was absolutely great, better than I could have possibly imagined, but we didn't have any money. We managed to get to Toronto and to Louisville by selling stuff. We had a couple of things that were worth something. It was a carpet and some other things. And we sold them and went to those places. And then we managed to get some money from Judith's parents, so we were able to join the Master in Santa Barbara. But in Louisville, Master Kripal asked me when I had my farewell interview, I went in to say goodbye to him just as he was leaving to go up to Minneapolis and we were coming back. He asked me if we needed any money. And I said, no, we didn't. Of course, we did. But I didn't want to tell him that we did. So he accepted it and we went off and was okay. And then toward the end of the tour in Miami, where the money that we had gotten were able to follow him was really running out. At the house where he was staying in Miami, he came out one day. I was out there, and he beckoned me and pulled me over underneath a tree. And he looked around, and he pulled out his wallet from his coat. And he said to me, and if he was not the Master of the Universe, I would have said that he was a little embarrassed, okay? And he said to me, very sweetly, I was wondering if maybe you needed a little financial help. And I said, oh, no, 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 Master. No, 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 no. Oh, golly, the idea of taking money from him, I just couldn't even bear it. And I said, no, 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 we're fine, we're fine. Of course, we weren't fine at all. And he accepted it, and he put his wallet back, and he didn't say anything more about it. When we got back home at the end of the tour, the next few months were the toughest of Judith and my married life together financially. I mean, we had spent every single cent that we possibly had. I wasn't working. I couldn't find a job right away. Luckily, what was now an ashram had been bought free and clear because it had been extremely inexpensive when we bought it. And we didn't have, like, telephone or a lot of things that required monthly payments. So we were able to make it, and in the spring I did get actually two jobs, and we were over the, you know, out of the problem. But it was rough. And sometime during that next year, I mentioned to Millie Prendergast what had happened, that the Master had offered me money and I hadn't taken it. And she said, why not? You take everything else from him. Why don't you take that? And I thought about it, and I thought, okay, all right, okay. Next time Master offers me money, I'll do whatever he wants. And so time went by, and in 1972, I was in India, actually with Judith, toward the end. And at some point toward the end of that stay, I left the master in Pathankot, in the Punjab near the Pakistan border, where he was on tour. And we drove back to Delhi from there to get our plane. But either there or in Delhi, I'm not sure which, before we left, he called me in, and I was pretty sick at that point. I was getting pneumonia, and when I got home, I was very sick for about a month. Anyway, I was just getting sick at this time, and he called me in, and he said, I was wondering if maybe you needed a little financial assistance, just like he had said before. This time I said, whatever you want to do, Master, I will take it. He said, all right. And he reached down and he brought up this metal box, like a chest, a case, and he opened it up and I looked at it. It was full of American money, just bills and bills all over the place. And he said, well, how much? And I said, totally up to you, Master. Whatever you want to give me, I will take. He said, all right. And he counted out 20, 40, 60. He said, is that enough? I said, whatever you want to give me, Master. All right. Counted out 20 more, on, 80. And ended up several hundred dollars, which, of course, this was many years ago now, at 72. And it was well over $1,000 or more by today's standards. Incredible amount of money. I really didn't, you know, I didn't want it, but I wanted to do what he wanted. And what Millie had said really got through to me. So he ended up giving me that money. And I took it home. And we needed it. And I was very grateful for it. Anyway, that was one story. The other one, which is equally interesting in my memory, has to do with being with Sanchi in Rajasthan. And one of the trips, one of the December trips that I used to go on, Group 4, at the very end of the trip, the last day, the day that we were going to go in the bus down to Delhi, I woke up and I had very severe stomach cramps and diarrhea. And this is bad news, and it is not something that was often a problem for me in India, but sometimes it was. And this was bad. I had not been sick on the trip previously, but anyway, I thought, all right, Master, it's up to you. You know, you got to get me down to Delhi, okay, I don't know how it's going to happen. But anyway, I got onto the bus and I was sitting there wondering what on earth the day was going to be like. And Sanchi got on the bus to say goodbye to everybody, and he went up and down the aisle. When he got to me, he pulled me by the hand, and he pulled me out, and he told me I was going to be going with him in the car. So, okay, great. So we got in the car, and there were just three people, a driver, whom I don't remember who was driving, and Sanchi and me. And Papu didn't come, and there was no translator. And as far as I knew, neither the driver nor Sanchi spoke any English. And I did not speak any, obviously, Punjabi or Hindi. So we started off, and we get about a few miles down the road, and Sanchi pulls out a bag of prasad, and it turns out they're cashew nuts. And he offers me some. And feeling the way I did, my stomach was cramping, I knew I had diarrhea, the last thing on earth that I wanted to eat was nuts. And I could not explain to him, you know, I mean, I felt like Ingrid was saying yesterday, I say, no, Master, I know about prasad, but I really can't do it today. This is what I felt like. But there was no way to say that. And besides, I knew that in the past, when I had occasionally demurred, he didn't like it at all. So I took the nuts and I ate them, and after a while he offered me more. And I took them, and then all the way down to Delhi, I fed on cashew nuts from his hands. And that's all that I had. There was no other food, and that's all that I had. And we got down there, and not only had I not had any diarrhea or any need to stop during the whole darn trip, the cramps were gone and I felt perfectly fine. And I often pondered that. We think that we understand what's going on with the Master. We don't understand anything. I've made this point a number of times, but I would not conclude from that cashew nuts are the things that will solve diarrhea or cramps, but I would conclude from it that Master has many, many, many ways of working, and he can do anything he wants. And as Sawan Singh once said, you know, he can make the stones do his work if he wants to. Anyway, those stories, both of them, the first one about the money was actually probably when I said to Ingrid that when the Master wants to give you something, you've got to take it. That was probably foremost in my mind at that time. But the other event happened later, of course. I do want to read a section from The Stranger of Galilee, which I probably won't read the whole section. I might continue this later. It's the chapter called False Prophets, but the reason I want to read it has to do with the difference between the positive and the negative power is, and this is what the substance of this chapter is about, is the difference between love and power. And we tend to think of Kaal, the negative power, as evil. You know, we equate him with Satan in the Judeo-Christian tradition, also Islamic. But in fact, the Masters really shied away from understanding Kaal as evil. Kripal was very explicit on this point, that he was the god of justice, that his people got what they wanted, but he was also the god of power. The lord of judgment, Dharmrai, is the god who makes things happen the way he wants them to happen, whereas the god of love takes a different course altogether. And to me, this understanding of this particular dichotomy is extremely helpful in understanding the reason behind many of the things that the Masters say, the commandments that they give, and also the choices that we have to make in the course of living our life the way he would like us to do. So, bearing that in mind, I will begin to read this section. It begins with a quote. This is, of course, my book on the Sermon on the Mount, commentary on that from the New Testament. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction, and there are many who take it. For the gate is narrow and the road is hard that leads to life, and there are few who find it. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and nor can a bad tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will know them by their fruits. And I comment, these two famous sections have had great resonance in Christian history and also in spiritual tradition in general. The narrow gate and the wide gate, leading to life and destruction respectively, are the two ways that in Sant Mat are called the way of the Gurumukh and the way of the Manmukh. However, they have certainly been misunderstood. In conventional religious terms, the righteous person is the one who keeps the commandments and leads an apparently respectable life in the outer world, and the sinful person is one who does not. But something more is suggested here, a theme that is found throughout this sermon and throughout the Gospels and the teaching of all masters. The two choices are not always conventional righteousness and conventional sinfulness, though they may take that form at certain times. The choice lies between power and love, that is, between the essence of the negative and the essence of the positive. The Lord Jesus, in this sermon, has been explaining in many different ways that we can relate to other people, to our outer circumstances, or to our own selves, either through power control or through love surrender. The way of the negative is the way of power. The way of the positive is the way of love. If we think of it in those terms, much of what is in the sermon and the Gospels and the teachings of all the masters becomes very clear. Throughout our readings, we have sensed the implicit question, who is it that we are following? We may say we are following a certain person, but if we are in our life manifesting the opposite of what that person teaches, to what extent are we really following him? We may want to be followers of the true God of love, forgiveness, mercy, gentleness, and compassion, and of someone who manifests that God. But if, in fact, in our dealings with others, our marriage partners, our children, or people who may be at our mercy for one reason or another, we are manifesting control, are we truly following him? The Master will accept whatever devotion we offer him, but the fact is that as long as we use power to control, we are not acting as his disciple at all, but as the disciple of Kao, the negative power. As with many other things, we seem to have to learn this fact from bitter experience after making the mistake often. We learn the hard way that these are the choices. It is a question of power or love, rigidity or softness, iron-bound control or letting go and surrendering. The relinquishing of our wish to control is the narrow gate that very few people can go through at any one time. When masters make statements like, few there be that find it, they don't, of course, mean forever and ever. They are speaking in the living present, and they mean that right now, at any given moment, there will be very few who go through the narrow gate. That doesn't mean that everybody will not go through ultimately. In the book called The Two Ways, Sanchi talks at length about the way of the Manmukh and the way of the Gurumukh. Manmukh means literally the person through whom the mind speaks, and the Gurumukh is the one through whom the Guru speaks. The mind is that part of ourselves that manifests the negative power. It is usually referred to in the New Testament as psuche, or as we would say in English, psyche, which is generally translated as soul. But in Santmat and in the esoteric tradition in general, it is the mind which is the sense of I-hood, of ego, of wanting power and control over our life and over the people in our life. The guru, when it manifests in us, is what we call the soul or spirit. In the New Testament, it is called panuma, that which recognizes and loves the God in others because it is of the same essence as itself. At the beginning of The Two Ways is found the following section from the Sarbachan. Please note how consistently the Manmukh and the Gurumukh are defined in terms of power and love. We often miss this because we see them in other terms, of asceticism and pleasure, for example, or of straightness and crookedness. But if we think of the concepts of power and love, the negative and positive in this context, we will see how much they figure in this classic description. We should also note two other things. First, these are not phrased or framed as commandments. Since they are presented as descriptions, we don't have to carry a load of guilt if we don't measure up to them very well. Rather, they are like the diary or a roadmap that makes us notice. If I'm doing that, well, I may be on the wrong track. The other thing to note is that it is easy to see these things as absolutes, but many of us may be a gurumukh at times and a manmukh at other times. It is very difficult to be perfect, and the gurumukh is basically perfect. He or she is someone capable of being a master. He may not be functioning as a master, but he has that capacity. Therefore, it's important to realize that we may reach for perfection, but it is very difficult to achieve it fully. And this is the quote from the Sarbachan of Swamiji Maharaj. It's actually section number 263 in book 2. He says, out of mercy, the Satguru always takes care of the jiva, the embodied or bound soul, and is desirous that all his disciples should have great love and faith in his feet. But the mind does not like that the jiva should attain this state. It therefore tries to draw him towards the enjoyment of sensual pleasures and wants the jiva to obey its dictates. The jivas should therefore continue their devotion at the feet of the Satguru, beware of the ambush of the mind, and see that they do not fall into its trap. A brief account of the ways of a gurumukh and the ways of a manmukh is given here to enable the jiva to test and regulate his conduct. The jiva should go on applying this test to himself. 1. The dealings of the gurumukh are always true and straight with everybody. He shuns evil and does not deceive anyone. Whatever he does for the Satguru and relies upon his mercy. A manmukh is sly and insincere in his dealings and will deceive others to secure his own interests. He depends upon his own cleverness and intelligence and wishes to proclaim himself. 2. A gurumukh controls his mind and senses and is humble in spirit. He puts up with taunting words, lends a willing ear to advice, and does not seek to be honored. A manmukh does not like his mind to be curbed. He does not like to submit to anyone or obey anybody, and is jealous of the greatness of others. 3. A gurumukh does not oppress anybody. He is always willing and ready to serve and please and wishes to do good to others. He seeks not his own fame or honor, but keeps happy and absorbed in the thoughts of the Satguru and in his holy feet. A manmukh dominates others and makes them serve him. He seeks honor and does not care for others except for his own selfish interests. He enjoys being honored and made much of, and does not remain absorbed in the holy feet of the Satguru. 4. A gurumukh never gives up his humility and gentleness. He does not resent it if he is slandered or slighted or shown disrespect. He regards all this as conducive to his own good. A manmukh fears slander and dishonor, does not willingly put up with disrespect, and solicits praise. 5. A gurumukh works hard and never remains idle. A manmukh seeks bodily ease and comfort and is lazy. 6. A gurumukh leads a simple and humble life and is ready to live contentedly on whatever falls to his lot, be it dry and unbuttered bread or rough and coarse clothing. A manmukh always loves and craves dainty dishes. He does not like to have dry and unbuttered bread and things of low value. 7. A gurumukh is not engrossed by earthly goods and the meshes of the world and feels no pain or pleasure in losing them or getting them. He is not upset by unbecoming remarks made against him. He keeps an eye on the salvation of his soul and on pleasing his Satguru. A manmukh thinks too much of the world and its goods. He feels pain if he loses them and pleasure if he gets them. If one talks harshly to him, he immediately flies into anger, forgets the grace and power of the Satguru, and does not rely on him. 8. A gurumukh is frank and sincere in all matters. He is liberal-minded, helps others, and wishes them well. He is contented with little and does not desire to take from others. A manmukh is greedy. He is always ready to take things from others but does not want to give. He always thinks of his own interest in everything and does not care for others. He goes on multiplying his desires and is not straight in his dealings. 9. A gurumukh is not attached to worldly people. He does not crave or care for pleasures or enjoyments, nor does he long for sightseeing and amusements. His only desire is to be at the feet of the Satguru, and he remains absorbed in that bliss. A manmukh loves worldly people and things, desires enjoyment and pleasures, and feels happy in sightseeing and amusements. 10. Whatever a gurumukh does to please his Satguru and craves for grace and mercy from him. He praises only the Satguru, wishes to see only him honored, and has no worldly desires. A manmukh has some self-interest or pleasure in whatever he does, for he cannot undertake anything which does not contribute to his self-interest. He wishes to be praised and honored, and the worldly desires predominate in him. 11. A gurumukh is not antagonistic towards anyone. Rather, he loves even those who are antagonistic to him. He is not proud of his family, caste, position, or the friendship of great men, and loves devoted and spiritually minded people. He always keeps alive his love and devotion in the feet of the Satguru, and always wishes to gain more and more the mercy and grace of the Satguru. A manmukh is anxious to have a big family and friends, courts rich and influential people, and is proud of the friendship of such persons and of his own caste. He always wishes to do things for show and cares little for the approval of the Satguru. 12. A gurumukh is not distressed by poverty and want, but bears with fortitude any calamity that may befall him, always trusts in the mercy of the Satguru, and is grateful to him. A manmukh is quickly distressed by adversity and calls aloud for help. He feels pain and grumbles if he is poor. 13. A gurumukh leaves everything to the divine will, and whether it turns out well or ill, he never brings in his own ego. He does not try to prove his own point, nor does he try to prove the hollowness of others. He will not permit himself to be entangled in controversial acts. Always watching the will of the Satguru, he passes his days singing the Satguru's praises. A Manmukh asserts himself in everything. For his own delight and gain, he undertakes things involving strife and dispute. He gets angry and is even ready to quarrel to maintain his own side. 14. A Gurumukh does not run after new and novel things, for he sees that they have their root in the material world. He conceals his own virtues from the world and does not like to be praised. From whatever he sees or hears, he selects that point which is calculated to contribute to his love and devotion for the Satguru, and goes on singing the praises of the Satguru, who is the treasure of all good. A Manmukh is always anxious to see and hear novel things. He is eager to pry into the secrets of others and to know their private affairs. He wishes to add to his intelligence and cleverness by gathering points from here and there with a view to display his great intelligence and secure praise, and is highly pleased when he is praised. 15. A Gurumukh is steady in the performance of spiritual practices, always relies upon the grace and mercy of the Satguru, and has unshaken faith in his holy feet. A Manmukh is hasty in everything and wishes to finish things hurriedly. In his haste, over and over again, he forgets his trust in the grace and mercy of the Satguru and in his words. 16. All that has been said about the conduct of a Gurumukh will be acquired solely by the grace of the Satguru. Only he to whom he is merciful will receive this gift. Those who love his holy feet and have faith in him will surely receive this gift one day. Love for the holy feet of the Satguru is the source of all virtues. All virtues will automatically come to him who receives the gift of love. Then all the Manmukh characteristics will disappear in a minute. Sarbachan 2.262. If we think about all of those things from the point of view of power and love, we will see that in each case the distinguishing characteristic of the Gurumukh is that he or she has learned to live his life as a way of love, whereas the Manmukh is interested in power. Kripal Singh's message of April 2, 1967, and his comments also develop the power and love dichotomy in very interesting ways. He goes far past the whole concept of dualism, because the two ways are very different in terms of their eternity. The way that leads to life goes upward and lasts forever. The way that leads to destruction goes around and around and around, and sooner or later it disappears. He also emphasizes the complete inappropriateness of using the concept of the two ways as a club with which to coerce people. Because if we follow the way of life to its ultimate goal, what do we find? We see that nobody is committed to the way of destruction in their inmost self, and we see the Lord working everywhere. Master Kripal says, and this is going to conclude this satsang this morning, there are two ways, one leading to life and the other to destruction, called Sharimarg and Pirimarg. Pere Marg relates to objective life and appears all beautiful and easy to follow, but it results in hatred and malevolence, rigid ideology, and obsessive self. The way of Shari Marg lies in developing inner silence, which is harder to find. It is an uphill task and takes hard work of mind and body and purification of spirit. When you will become broad-minded and have risen to the heights of life by sacrificing everything, you will find a vision of the Lord working in all alike, in saints and sinners, in all men and in all creation, in all birds and beasts, in all religions, in all scriptures, and in all prophets. In silence, we test ourselves to find weaknesses to be weeded out. We have to wrestle with darkness and develop moral muscles and receive the message of the Spirit. We must be, for some time at least, alone with God. When we enter more and more into silence, our desires will be eliminated, purity will be attained, and the body and the mind sanctified, and we taste the elixir of Nam Divine and know how sweet the name is. In silence, the heart illumines. Veil after veil is removed. In the heart shineth the light, and the very silence becomes vocal, giving vent to the music of the spheres, reverberating in all creation. When the light is seen shining within your heart, and the music of the spheres becomes audible, you behold the light in all. That is, outside, you see the one light in all. This is the universal vision, that the one is in all and all are in one. Blessed is he, the man of illumination, for wherever he be, he dwelleth with the one eternal. Such a blessed one belongeth not to this color or caste or creed. He belongeth to all. The great mystic Rumi says, I am neither Christian nor Jew, neither Gaber nor Turk. I am not of the East, I am not of the West. I am not of the land, not of the sea. I belong to the soul of the Beloved. I have seen that the two are one, and one I see and one I know, one I see and one I adore. He is the first and he is the last. He is the outward, and he is the inward too. This is the ultimate goal before each one of you. I wish all who care to achieve this goal, all feasible help of the Master, will be at hand. And I'm going to leave out there and leave us with those thoughts. God bless us all.